This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Outdoor Edge Knives. Now, Outdoor Edge has a large range of fixed and replaceable blade knives and game cleaning kits. Now, imagine this. You just shot a deer in the backcountry or an elk or whatever, and it's time to break it down, right? It's hot. You're a long way from the truck, so time is a factor, and you got to get the meat back to the truck so there's no waste. Your blade becomes dull, so instead of having to stop and sharpen the blade, all you do is you take your Outdoor Edge knife, you push a button on the handle, the blade pops out, you put a new blade back in, and you're back to work. You get back to the truck, there's no wasted meat, everybody wins. Now, if you want to find out more information about Outdoor Edge and their complete line of knives and game cleaning kits, all you have to do is go to outdooredge.com, and when you check out or you decide you want to purchase a knife, enter the discount code NATION30 and you're going to save 30% off of your purchase. That's NATION30 and that's outdooredge.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Welcome back, Land and Legacy Podcast. We're here inside. No background noise tonight other than kids screaming outside, if they can hear it. Or inside on the other side of this wall that we're sitting in.
Maybe just a little bit of crying at some point.
Yeah, a little
disregard.
Usually we record in the backyard, but we are inside tonight because it's about 20-something degrees, 30-mile-an-hour winds, it seems like, and snow.
Blowing snow.
Yeah, so yeah, the fire that one pit wouldn't provide much warmth.
No.
But here it is. I think we're podcast 280. What are you calling these again?
This is the Vegetation Series.
Vegetation
Podcast Series.
Yep. Trees.
We're doing trees this week.
This is the last one.
Correct. Correct.
And I've heard a lot of great things, so we're going to try to find... Do you have a new series in mind coming up?
There's a couple I'm pondering, yes.
I think we need to do... We haven't ever done it, but have we? I don't think we have.
What?
We haven't done the regional management. We never did the northern, midwest, south. northeast or whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You could really do a two-part series, north and south.
Yep, yep. But no, we haven't done that. There's certainly a series that we could break out. We can get super detailed if we want and break into smaller regions, but largely you can do southeast, southwest, northwest, and northeast. But yep. That's certainly one of them. But there's a couple other we're tossing around. So
one thing I
like the feedback from you guys. I appreciate it.
What I like, you know, with this series is to talk about, you know, I find myself describing land management. We're in the middle of consulting season now as we really ramp up, and I've been traveling, you've been traveling, and I find myself using the analogy of to landowners that land management is basically your farm is a big puzzle, and mm-hmm. there's trees, shrubs, grasses, forbs, and they're all a piece of that puzzle, and without them all being present, it's an incomplete puzzle.
And they're not mutually exclusive of each other. It doesn't mean that you have us like, dope, that's where my shrubs are, this is where my grasses are, that's where my trees are. No.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that.
And it's like I was in Oklahoma a few days ago, and there was a 40-acre native prairie, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was like, this looks good, but it's one of three that I'm really want. I want way more forbs and sure. I want more shrubs.
Right.
Because right now, as it is, it's pretty barren. Even though native grass is great, it's not the end all be all.
Right. Right. There were still other factors that were missing to make it more usable for probably a lot of other wildlife.
Absolutely. So,
This has honestly been the point of trying to do this series is to build on things week after week and talk about how, you know, we see it, we talk about it often of there's just a specific plant that everyone's worried about or consumed with. It's like this year everyone's going to be consumed with X and it's like, no. We've got to understand the full side of vegetation. Let's break it down and move through it. So then, right, we can build and see what the roles are from each one.
And I think as I discussed that series of north and south, the difference. So one week would be management in the north, one would be management in the south, and maybe a third one would be management in the Midwest, somewhere in the middle. I had a virtual property today, mm-hmm. actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we had made it an hour and 15 minutes into it, and I hadn't even mentioned bedding thickets.
Right.
And right. I think that, like, the way we consult is so much. So we talk. I mean, we're here every week, 2 hours a week almost. We're mm-hmm. on the podcast, and so people can hear us talk constantly. We got videos dropping on YouTube. And you might think that we're going to get to your farm, we're going to say this, 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 and go. Like, you already have an idea. But today, I found myself, we were talking about it, and I mentioned bedding thickets an hour and 15 mm-hmm. in, and he goes, I was wondering if we were going to, like, kind of like, okay, that's what I was wondering if you had mm-hmm. any of those in mind. I forget how he phrased it, but, and it was just like, I enjoy the way we consult. Obviously, it's what we believe in, and I'm not arrogant enough to think that we have it 100% figured out.
Sure.
Because you're always tweaking, you're always trying to learn, you're always trying to improve, and we're trying to find, you know, different native species that we can promote more in different spots on the farm or different sites. But, you know, I think that's a big part of what we do as consulting is we really don't know till we get there what we're going to lay out. But sometimes we might not even touch bedding thickets because we may be talking totally different. His farm, you know, it was one of those farms where it's kind of a mix, recreational, trying to make a little money mm-hmm, or just mm-hmm. doing a few things. And I'm like, alfalfa? I mean, this guy's in a part of the country that's
a lot of horse country.
A lot of horses.
Way. Yep. Yep.
And it's like, alfalfa, hey, no problemo.
Yep.
Get somebody to pay you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have a 7 acres of food plot, really, in a part of the world where that's going to outcompete corn or soybeans.
Yeah.
4 out of 5 years, when mm-hmm. you look at 12-month interval, it's going to do better.
And, you know, If you want to get jump on the season at that in that state, it comes in early, and you got an amazing early season food source.
Totally. Totally.
It just everything matches. But
and then all the slopes. What is it? Mm-hmm. All the slopes look just like, I think, the old trophy farms with Todd.
Mm-hmm. And Oldfield?
And the Oldfield. My goodness, he had so much Oldfield.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, there's where a large majority of cover. We're going to promote some shrubs. We're going to move some down tree structures in. And we're going to do a little edge feathering. And then the other kicker was he had about 35 acres of marketable cedar timber.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's your bedding. Like, unfortunately, you're not going to be able to be, well, you can't define it in a direction like you could with bedding thickets and big timber. But we know 35 acres out of over 100, we have a pretty good idea they're in those areas that are going to get cut. So
and it's going to be supplying a ton of food and cover and be pulling and holding a lot of deer with a food source like that and that much cover.
And how could you not fall in love with that? You're getting somebody's paying you to plant your food and somebody's paying you to put your bedding in.
Mm-hmm.
What's not to love? You do a little bit of old field burning.
Burn.
I mean, this guy's going to have drastically better farm than his neighbors. And
for sure.
He got paid to do it.
Yeah. Not bad.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at it. And that's the thing. I know we've done a podcast and I think we titled it something to the extent of, you know, there's no cookie cutter plan out there.
Yeah.
And that is the surprise. We've been super blessed. And this is a whole nother podcast topic that we'll cover at some point, for just, if you will, the origin, how we got here. But like, we've been scheduled out for several months, and there's a lot of people who have been trying and wanting to take advantage of, you know, the dormant season, let's call it the habitat season, prior to us getting there. And, you know, had a couple phone calls, had a couple, you know, meetings or looking over maps and just look at things. But at the same time, I have a hard time recommending like any drastic projects to be done, because it's like, I don't want to get there and recommend something and be like, well, darn. Yeah,
if you're going to be there anyway, you know?
Yeah. I don't want to jump the gun on something, because a comprehensive understanding of the plant communities that are there, the terrain, the topography, all of that makes a humongous difference in how you do something or why you do something, where you do something.
Compare that to the virtual properties. Like, I don't know how many photos I looked at for today.
Right.
75 to 100.
Right, right.
I mean, I saw every angle of these whole fields. So that's kind of the difference. But, you know, if we're going to be there in 2 weeks, let's just hold off.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But it is, it's, you know, you want to take advantage of the time. But again, this puzzle is complex, and it's not one that you could just say, oh, well, here are the four techniques that I want to use. Let's just use them. Well, maybe that technique doesn't fit perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel such like we're kind of a younger crowd, I guess, when it comes to speaking on conservation and doing this conservation type management. But here we are, it's 9 o'clock at night and we're in a nursery right now with toys all around us and I'm drinking milk. Like, I feel so
I texted you, I don't know, maybe it was yesterday or the day before. I was like, hey, when are we doing this podcast? I know it's probably got to be Friday because I'm going to be gone Saturday and Sunday. And I don't want to be up super late on Friday night recording late into the night because I got to leave at like 4:30 tomorrow morning. So can we do this a little bit earlier? Yep. Getting up there.
Oh, shout out to Chris, too, for the water bottle.
Oh, yeah.
Appreciate Chris it. I know Patton. He's listening.
Yep.
All appreciate right. It, let's jump into trees.
Trees.
So if we were going to take the 4 weeks and we say grasses, forbs, shrubs, trees, and you were to look and say, okay, let's just they're all important, but let's just rank them on favorites or
value.
You know, I think they're all important, but I think some you can get by without, and I think so many people think trees mean habitat.
Well,
you see it in real estate listings all the time.
Oh yeah,
plenty of trees, whole big bucks.
Or you see that, or you know, there's so many people doing, you know, online scouting, e-scouting or whatever, and they're looking out and some stuff in the Midwest. They're like, well, that one's got cover, that one doesn't.
Yeah,
and they're looking at trees, and it's like, that doesn't mean cover. Like, that doesn't constitute a good cover.
No.
And I think a lot of places, public ground opportunities west are very overlooked because they think, oh, gosh, it's just wide open. There's no way I'm going there. When there's a huge shrub component that doesn't show up on maps really at all, or very, very difficult in some cases, and there's deer everywhere. There's game. Yeah. It's game rich.
Yep.
So, if I was going to rank them, obviously I would want to know ahead of time what species we're talking about in particular. But if I'm just going to rank in general wildlife value, I'm probably going to go with shrubs, forbs, trees, grass.
I would probably go.
The first two are probably be flipped, and I wouldn't care either way.
I was going to say forbs, shrubs, grasses, trees. Because I came at it from a quail approach and was like, I'd rather have the grasses than the shrubs, or than the trees.
Yeah, for that I can understand.
Yeah.
But see, that's two, right? Like, kind of where I preface
that's
that.
That's personal preference, really.
It's like, what is it you're managing for? Everyone, you know, has different things there. But
now,
like,
if my thing was turkeys.
Yeah.
Then I would probably put trees pretty high on that list.
Mm-hmm.
And there's overall,
hard mast is super important to a turkey.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like I said, regardless, for both of us in our situations, trees were either third or fourth place.
Yep.
I know there's someone out there saying, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah, they were thinking we saved the best for last.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the one we least wanted to talk about in the last.
Absolutely, absolutely.
No doubt. First off, I love trees. Second off, I love cutting trees.
And there's a lot of people out there, I think, who are, you know, like, all you guys talk about is cutting trees. Well, number one, before we get like really into this, there's way too many trees on the landscape.
Most of the time, yeah.
Like from where historically...
Look at the landscape across the country. People say that deforestation is happening across the globe. Yeah, it's happening in some places.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not here in the United States.
There's
in the U.S.
of
A,
trees.
We have a lot of trees. And because we have a lot of trees, we have a lot of very unhealthy trees.
Extremely.
The stocking rate, just the amount of trees per acre in a lot of these forests is just sickening.
Like, and I feel bad for a lot of people who aren't aware of that. And then when we go to a property and you know, let's just say we're on a ridgetop and we say, okay, now, from what you've been gaining information-wise from us throughout the day, tell me what trees are valuable here. Tell me what trees are good and healthy. And when you just pause and take 5 minutes the next time you're in the woods, be critical, look at the trees, and don't look at, like, eye level. Look up in the canopy. Look for stress. You will find in most places that there's honestly, I would say comfortably 50-60% of the trees are unhealthy.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And that's a comfortable
unhealthy
guess.
Or crooked stressed. Or very stressed.
Yep. And again, we're not saying every place needs 50-60% of the trees removed.
And that closed canopy is bad.
Right.
Because there's some instances where closed canopy is needed.
Yep.
Or that's the native site. But so many times closed canopy happens. If there's trees, it's closed canopy.
Yeah.
And unmanaged.
And then that's the shame, if you will. Why have a closed canopy where we know the value is 50-100 pounds of digestible food per acre? Why have it in so much of the property in that manner, but then have so many trees that are already unhealthy? When, again, we're not saying that we hate trees, but literally what would happen to your habitat if 50% of them across the property, the unhealthy ones, not like just super, super healthy ones, but the unhealthy ones were gone. Oh. And it wasn't closed canopy timber. It was a managed woodland. I love woodlands.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're amazing.
Well, I talked with a guy earlier this week who had in between 400 and 500 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And he said 95% of it is timber.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I asked for a picture of his timber, saw it. Ooh, okay. He said, there's a browse line. I'm like, okay, let's plug some numbers in here. And I forget what the numbers were, but basically taking that 50 to 100 pounds,
mm-hmm.
if you take it, okay, let's just say that you have 700 acres. And that 700 acres is closed canopy forest.
Yep.
And you take that and you go, okay, 50 to 100 pounds, so let's just call it 75 pounds, okay?
Yep.
That is 52,500 pounds of forage available on average a year.
25 deer would hold? I mean, would support?
You would divide that by 2,000.
Because right. That's how much a deer eats per year.
Yep. So about 26 deer.
Yep.
Isn't that shocking?
700 acres.
On 700 acres, you honestly could feed 26 deer.
Mm-hmm. And again, that doesn't include hard mass production because that's so variable each and every year. But that's an on average digestible food per acre. Well, and let's just say you managed the woodlot and you just turned it into a woodland. And
so you got 700.
I was going to say, give it 500 pounds of food per acre.
Okay.
A nice managed woodland that had some fire.
It's 350,000.
350,000 pounds of food. Divide by 2,000.
175.
So we went from 26 deer to 175. We're not talking about that's the number, that's how many you're going to hold, this and that. It's just simply to say, that's the value of food that you're increasing. And a lot of times that food that's, has cover value as well. So we're not saying that it's healthy to have this 175 deer on the 700 acres, but at least
your deer shouldn't be as stressed.
But right. And it's still to say a managed woodland with less trees is more productive than a closed canopy forest.
Yeah. From a lot of reasons.
Huge.
Think of Dr. Craig Harper's research where they studied oak trees for 10 mm-hmm. years, fertilizing versus non-fertilizing, ID and crop trees, and releasing those trees. A woodland, basically, if you ID those trees and you release those trees, what is the numbers again? 30% of your oaks produce...
40% okay. of the hard mass trees produce 70% of the acorns.
Okay, let's say you left those 40% and they increase. And what was the percentage that they increased? 43%? 43 to 44%?
I don't remember,
but I just remember it was above 30
mm-hmm.
that it produced. And so,
regardless, and even if you don't go in and identify the top producers with that math, if you go and you cut trees, you will be increasing acorn like mass production.
So you go in with a chainsaw thinking that you're going to, you know, that because you're cutting trees, you're not going to have as many acorns or as much mass.
Fallacy.
You're not only improving the amount of acorns produced, but the amount of forbs and other plants and even the cover component in the understory.
And we should say, and yes, that all depends on the trees you're selecting to cut and the composition, but just generally speaking, if you have a oak hickory type forest and you're thinning that forest and you're actively managing it, you're probably going to have more mass production, healthier trees, and a robust understory of forbs and brambles and woodland shrubs and whatever coming underneath. Like,
yeah,
it will be
just
thriving. It will be more diverse, and you will have less trees, but you will have healthier trees. And you know, honestly, what the other thing is that is just, I guess, irritating is like when you have unhealthy trees, you have open wounds, you have more opportunity for insects or more opportunity for that are susceptible to funguses.
At pines down south, and you get pine beetle kills like crazy.
Yep, you get oak, there's gypsy moss that can come through, there's oak blight.
The more stressed your trees are, the more susceptible they are for disease or insect kill.
Absolutely.
And so if you're create
setting
healthier
them up for failure.
Tree, it's just like this whole, I think my knee.
They just pop?
Listen.
Oh.
Oh.
Ouch.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to see a doctor soon because my knee is jacked up. But that was my that my knee yeah, just that did was, that. But anyway, so sorry, took my breath away. I think a lot of times that well, right now we're in a world, we're under a pandemic right now, and what we do know is that healthier people are fighting off the virus more than the unhealthy people.
Well, and the other factor is socially distance. That's what we're talking about doing with the trees. Give them some room to breathe.
Yeah.
And so they're not crowded out. And this is the other thing I guess I keep trying to remind people of when we're evaluating trees to look at, you know, health and how many are actually probably going to ever amount to anything or produce something. It's like when you look up and you see a closed canopy forest, see all these branches competing with one another, and that tree's not even growing branches on the right side because of this other big tree, and it's in the upper story or the mid story, all this stuff. It's like there's so much competition for just space and sunlight in the canopy. Imagine what's happening below your feet.
Oh, yeah.
If a root system is about the width of the canopy, then you know there's competition for soil moisture, minerals within the soil, just root space for them to grow and spread.
Uh-huh.
They can't grow and spread if the canopy's full too. You can't grow at a rate that will actually produce something that, and we'll get into this later on, trees have a great income potential for properties, but not if they're not in a situation that will allow them to grow and prosper.
Yeah.
There go unhealthy forests, which we see and deal with all the time.
Yeah, and I just, those numbers just kill me where I think it really opened that guy's eyes. What's the dream? Like if you could just throw out a number, you're like, if you own 2,000 acres, 3,000 acres, that would be like,
sure,
let's do it.
Like, I'd love it.
That's amazing. So let's just say 2,500 acres, all right? And you do 75 pounds because it's closed canopy. That's 187,500 pounds of forage.
Yeah.
If you divide that by 2,000, that's 93 deer that you could feed on 2,500 acres.
Right.
I mean, those numbers should just come out of the podcast and smack you in the face.
Yeah.
Because if you have closed canopy, you should be going, oh, one of the podcasts coming up is going to be titled kind of something along this line, but is like, that's when you know you can starve out some deer, is when you're not managing your timber and you have vast acres and acres and acres. And how many national forests are acres and 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 acres of closed canopy forest?
There's humongous. It's not just national forest in the West. We're talking, I grew up and went to college close to the George Washington and Thomas Jefferson that stretched through North Carolina, Tennessee, West Virginia, and North Carolina. Vast amounts of acres.
Yeah.
And they're reducing tags and everything throughout those areas just because of the unproductivity and the lack of management in those areas, the forested areas.
And it's no wonder the rough grouse is struggling.
Yeah, totally, totally. But so I guess that's a good preface for trees.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And maybe why they're third and fourth on our list.
We got too many of them most of the time.
So, yeah, in a nutshell, there's too many trees out there, and I think that's a great little snippet into what we'll get into for the rest of the podcast. But number one, we've been starting out with a definition of what they are. Everyone knows what a tree is, but essentially compared to shrubs, forbs, and grasses, it's a woody perennial plant typically having a single stem or trunk growing to a considerable height and bearing lateral branches at some distance from the ground.
Yeah, I was trying to pull up a shrub definition.
That was a multi-stemmed
woody structure that doesn't get much taller than like 8 feet or something like that.
Yep. So obviously still has some components of a tree with the woody aspect, but is generally a single stem and has considerable height and lateral branches. There's probably 10,000 ways to be able to break out trees and categorize them, but way we've kind of chose to do it for this week and try and make it as applicable to wildlife as possible, talking about hard mast, soft mast, we'll talk about the different oak families, And we'll talk about just general other types of trees. We'll talk about the mid-story trees, because I think, honestly, the mid-story aspect of a canopy is super underrated, but
unmanaged.
And yeah. Honestly, they think, oh, it's a little tree. It's not doing anything. It's actually doing more harm than it is good, right? They just think small. Okay, it's inconsequential, but it's not the case. And then we'll go into a couple non-native trees out there as well, and then cover benefits, this and that. So we got the definition, hard mass.
Yeah,
I mean
acorns.
That's it. White oak. I mean white oak family, and then the red oak family is just. It takes the cake, right?
And that's what everybody thinks. Or beech.
Yeah. There's so many different types of those white or red oak.
I was trying
families.
To look here and see what we had for our list of hard mass. And
so for just hard mass.
You're missing the biggest ones, man. The game changers of all game changers.
What did I miss?
I'll sarcastically tell them in a little bit.
I know which one you're throwing out there.
Two of them.
So just hard mast in general, we have white oak, red oak, post oak, turkey oak, nuttall, hickory, beech. Those are obviously just examples of hard mast. But when we break it out to, let's just, white oak family, we have white oaks, post oaks, chinkapins, burrs, swamp white oaks, chestnut oaks, the chestnut, and many others. What were you?
I'm trying to think here. If you got them all, like overcup oak.
Overcup.
Yeah. I think that pretty well covers the main ones that people would think of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most would fall into.
What you have? Well, we both have a favorite in there. Burr oak.
Yep. Yep.
And then chinkapin is next, another good, probably cool high on that list.
And then so those are generally the white oak family.
Yeah.
Lobed leaves, but again. They're just, it's a tree, right?
1 year cycle acorns.
Yep. Yep. I think so many people get caught up in splitting out like, oh, well, what kind of oak is it outside of red or white? Yeah. Like, and there's preferences and this and that, but honestly, sometimes I feel like we can get into the weeds of trying to, like, you complicate things for yourself when you're out there trying to make management decisions of cut tree or don't cut tree.
Yeah.
And it's like, just try and have a balance of whites and reds.
Yeah.
And what's and naturally growing in your... Yeah, because that's the important thing. It's like, yes, deer will preferential, you know, go to certain trees or... But honestly, when you think about it, it may not be necessarily a flavor or taste kind of preference, but it could be... There's more acorns underneath of that tree. So, like, the opportunistic, like, I don't have to walk as much. I don't have to search. I can go to that tree. And so
I always wondered, here's a question I always wondered. Do you think deer know that with white oak acorns, it seems like they have a preference over white oak acorns versus red oak acorns?
When
do
both
you
are falling, yeah.
People are like, because there's more, basically, red oak acorns more acidic, so they don't taste as well. They need some time to break down. Or do you feel like deer know that those spoil quicker? I'm going to eat them while they're still available.
I think it's a combination of both.
Yeah, I can't get in a deer head, but...
Right. I think absolutely
sometimes
I
think they probably think differently than what we assume they think.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me wonder, you know, they're all about survival.
Totally.
And if somebody gave me apples versus nuts, like a bunch of... walnuts or whatever, I'd be like, well, the apples are going to spoil faster. I'm going to eat those first.
Right. I can save those.
And I can save those.
Well, because that's the thing. It's they're genetically, you know, engineered to prepare their bodies for winter, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to start eating on red oaks if they taste better or not, because these white oaks over here aren't just flat out. They're not going to be here.
Yeah.
And so they can begin to consume those, rely on the red oaks later on. I mean, honestly, that's my thinking. It's sure there is a difference in the tannin level, but it's obviously a survival aspect in it too. I think it's multifaceted, but what was I gonna, you were saying something and I was saying something and come
Well, out. you go right into white oaks from red oaks.
What? I remember. I was talking about just quantity of a tree producing. Like, it's much easier. So if you have a healthier forest and you're cutting trees around, crop tree releasing, what have you, you're managing a forest, you know, you're going to be increasing the quantity that individual trees are producing. So it's much easier to go to one tree because there's tons of acorns there and reduce, you know, searching and scavenging, let's say, for others. What do we got for red oaks there?
Oh, you've got your typical northern and then southern reds. So you've got northern reds, you've got southern reds, you've got water oaks, turkey oaks, willow oaks,
shingle oaks.
You know, pointed leaves.
Yep.
2-year acorn cycle.
Yep.
And I think that Chad and I were having that conversation about a month back of how God's intricate design allows animals to survive better. So, you know, you think about it. However long you want to agree that animals have been on this planet, they've managed to make it this long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when everything, you know, if they're a prey species, every predator tries to eat them, and they have to deal with all kinds of stuff. They're out there year round for their entire life, so they're pretty hardy animals. But you look at the oaks. You can just break it down and say, well, why are some 2 years, some are 1 year? So white oak will flower and produce an acorn all in 1 year, while a red oak will flower and then produce an acorn for the next year. And so they may have acorns every single year, but they flowered and pollinated the previous year.
Correct.
And I think it's so amazing that God put it this way, to where in years where you have a really late frost,
like 2020,
and you know that white oaks aren't going to produce any acorns, it's like, well, there was a boomer crop last year, and there's red oak acorns everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and that's what the wildlife can use to survive.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it's awesome to see that. I mean, I remember. This year in late April, early May, I was working in Kentucky, kind of western Kentucky and then central Kentucky, and it was back-to-back days, both just a cold snap late in April, and it was frosted. I mean, like a hard frost, and oaks were blooming. And then I remember I guess that was our turkey season too. Bud out. Everything was wanting to bud out and whatnot the first week, and then it got cold, and then like it did not continue to bud out and the vegetation understory come on and really bloom out like it typically would the third week. It was like this warm snap before turkey season.
Oh yeah,
wanted to start greening up, and then they just like shut down. But
and it's
fascinating.
How many times have you know? Seems like we said a lot in the last 5 years. Ooh, spring greenup's happening early this year.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel like it's happening like a month before. And then all of a sudden you get one of those cold spells.
It's
you're like
put on the brakes.
Now it feels like it's going to be delayed.
Yep.
Certainly. So, man.
But it is amazing that God's design just prepared nature and wildlife to be able to survive on any given year based on they just splitting up the way that these produce acorns. So and that is the most important thing about obviously the oak species, is they produce a very considerable amount of mass that so many different species of wildlife rely on.
And
so that's why trees are necessary to have on the landscape, but manage trees.
Yep.
Because I would like to know this number. Let's just give like 100 acres of closed canopy, just your typical oak hickory forest. You know, have that as control, and then go in and manage the 100 acres with ample space, ample sunlight, crown growth, everything for the next 10 years, and see what acorn production, like, you know, per year would add up and be different, right?
Yeah.
Same exact acre, but just that managed forest versus others. What is that mass increase?
Yep.
Because if you're going to have an oak, here's the whole point is,
if you're going to have an oak species, why have it where it's a turd? Like, why have it where it's stressed? Why have it where it's not producing and doing something? The role that it has, why are you not putting it in a growth form or a situation, environment where it can do its job?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense. Then then at that point, it's just wasted space, or it's, or it's a pointless tree.
Well, I looked at, you know, Chad and I cut out on this glade on the Prairie Hollow property over the last 2 months. We've been cutting cedars and thinning it out, trying to open it up, making a really nice native glade. And there's been several decent red oaks on that. Mm-hmm. West-facing slope, dry climbing. I mean, the glade is as close to a desert as we can get in the Ozarks. And I'm like, you know, it's a pretty tree.
Yeah.
Grow somewhere else. This is not a site for you. You're not going to thrive. You're going to survive.
Especially this is start burning
this. This is a chinkapin spot.
Yep.
If you want to be an oak, be a chinkapin.
Mm-hmm.
And until you can change your genetics, I'm sorry, but you got to go.
You're gone. You're gone.
And it's not that I hated that tree. I would promote that tree on the east facing slope.
Sure. But sure.
In that site, no. I'm wasting space for rough blazing star, cylindrical mm-hmm. blazing star, any of those beautiful forbs.
Which is rarer, which is more important, which isn't going to grow on that east facing slope, yep. though, too. It's like every, and this is, again, the whole reason for the podcast series is everything has a role. And if we don't identify that role and we just have things growing willy-nilly across a property, then I can just about promise you the way that the land has been managed or the way that there are not disturbances naturally occurring, there should be things that are misplaced. There's going to be things that are in situations where they shouldn't be. We see it quite often. Sycamores growing on ridgetops.
Yeah, it's cut a pile of those.
It's like, this should not be growing here. You are next to the creek, and that's your role, and I don't want to see you anywhere
it's
else.
It's a dry spot up here.
Yeah. It's like, you have to put things in check, and that's what we're doing with the oak trees and managing a forest is putting them in check and saying, if you're going to be here and your role is for mass production, by golly, I'm going to make sure there's an environment where you're going to produce that mast. If not, you're gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that people just overvalue, though. Oh, they're here.
Well, it's just like that podcast we did, the Common Lies or whatever, and one of those mm-hmm. was trees will save the environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so many people have bought into that we got a deforestation is happening across the globe when it's not. It's happening in places, but it's not right here in our backyards. We got too many trees. We got too many invasives. We got too many problems.
The last thing we need to do is
put the chainsaws up.
Oh, absolutely. Just a quick note on that, because some people are like, well, how is that even possible, guys? Well, think of a closed canopy forest. You have basically roughly the same height canopy across the entire landscape or large majority of the landscape. What happens when you go in and you actually cut it? You have varying ages of trees. You have shrubs. You have grasses and brambles and forbs underneath of all that. So when rain hits, if it hits that surface that is all the same, it's going to fall from that surface and not hit anything or interfere with anything once it falls off leaves until it hits the actual ground itself. And so, in comparison, if you go to the managed site, let's say woodland, where you have all those other species, once it hits a canopy that's uneven, it'll start to trickle down, then it'll hit some shrubs, then it'll hit some mid-story trees, then it'll hit some brambles, and then it'll work its way into the soil at a much slower pace, reducing erosion, increasing infiltration, instead of just flat runoff.
Yeah.
So, it's like, if you have this diversity on the landscape, you're directly impacting groundwater. And you don't get that unless you're honestly cutting trees.
Yeah.
So there's a happy medium in between all of this that we really do need to have. But like I said, trees are not the savior to, you know, water and
no
and everything. So
yeah.
Other mass producing species: walnut, hickory, pecan, and honey locust. Just other ones that, you know, they have a role. Some squirrels.
Did you pound say hickory. Chestnuts?
I did not say chestnuts.
Chestnuts.
Yep.
Because we still do have a few mm-hmm. escapee American chestnuts on the landscape. We have the Ozark chinkapin, mm-hmm. which is a chestnut.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's
Allegheny
that?
Chinkapin.
Yeah, there you go. That's the other one. Yep.
Squirrels love hickories. Bears will pound on hickory nuts.
Yeah.
So those
did you say beech too?
I said beech.
Okay.
I put beech somewhere. I put beech on the general hard mast.
Okay.
Producers.
Yeah. There's another one for you. Turkeys, especially. If,
love them.
The thing about it is too, how many times do you see beech tree with very few beech nuts?
I mean, it's pretty.
It's got to be the same thing with the oak.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much competition.
And my dad was actually, I was just talking to him on the phone the other day. We were talking about, I don't know why beech trees came up, but he's got just a little bit of woods on the property. And he's like, when I was seeing turkeys, they were underneath the beeches this year and they were scratched. So, you know, this year in Virginia and where he was at, there was beech nuts.
Yeah.
Probably won't be the case for another 5 years,
yeah.
but they do have a nut. And it comes in a cool little shell, kind of like the Allegheny chinkapin. But anyhow, they're certainly a mass producer. But soft mass, another aspect
of a tree.
I'm going
to add you a really good one on the – oh, no, you got it on there, soft mass. So you got maples. What do you got here? Soft mass. We
soft
got
mass,
eight.
Yep.
Okay, nope, it's on the wrong line. So you got apples.
Yep.
Pears, cherries, persimmons, peaches, hackberry, cedars.
Cedars do have, yeah.
That was the one I was going to add.
Yeah.
And then what other ones do we have that are trees that produce soft mass? That's pretty much it that comes to mind. Mulberries.
Sassafras.
Mulberries.
Yeah, mulberries for sure. Gosh.
Oh. It would probably be soft.
Dogwood would be a soft
mass
too.
Bodark, hedge apple.
Yeah. yeah.
Not that, real soft.
The, that's, I was say, that's
give
the softest thing on the on that tree, but yeah, it's not that soft.
Yep.
Sure enough.
And deer eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Squirrels hammer it. So you got hedge trees. They eat the leaves like crazy.
Oh, man, yeah. Yep.
And the mulberries. So,
which is funny because, you know, typically when you're in, let's say the prairie, there's lots of hedge. There's lots of mulberries. But those are some of the tree species that will grow out there. When you think about how much fire would have been prevalent and where those trees would have grown, they would have been set back often. And those leaves in that system would have been super available for deer, right? One, they even if they're more of a full-grown, they have really low branches that deer can consume. But if you had fire, they're getting set back constantly, and out there, deer pound those leaves
on
re-sprouts and everything. So anyhow, there's value to just beyond if there is mass production on some of these examples that we're sharing. But fruit trees get so much love. Fruit trees get over an abundant love. I know we've covered it in a lot of other podcasts.
Oh man, you love them.
That is false.
Yeah. Apples, pears, cherries. So here's something about cherries too. Cherries, you've got your almost your domesticated varieties where pie cherries, mm-hmm. you're going to make pie out of them. And then there's just the wild cherry, which the guy asked me recently, he's like, I never see cherries. I'm like, because they're a little bit smaller than those
tiny.
Than those ones you're thinking you get on top of your sundaes.
Birds will pound them. Coons will climb up, shake them down. Like you're probably not going to see them.
Nope. So you got that for soft mass.
And persimmons is another huge one that everyone loves to look at, gander out, propagate, and clear around.
I mean,
all of it. Cool, but I'm not interested in investing that much time when I can get way more food out of doing something else in that area. Or I'm not going to plant that tree because of that unless everything else on the property is completely done.
Yeah.
That is,
or
if
my
you will,
kids want to do that.
Dude, I got another pun. Get it? You ready? Hold on. It's the cherry on top.
Oh, man.
Come on. That's a good one. You know, when everything else is done, the cherry on top is fruit trees, something else that if you ever get done
bad.
With. No, it's not. That was a good one. if you get everything else done, then it's the time and place to begin to try and get fruit trees going, in my opinion. But that's the other, let's say, aspect of fruit tree management. We talked about insects and disease and how fragile that they are, and trying to get them to grow and produce a lot of forage. But they're very susceptible to wind, to ice, to the weight of the fruit they're trying to bear, if not maintained properly. And then once they break, there's insects that will bore in them, kill them, funguses.
Yep.
There's just so many things that
even take, apple trees here in the Ozarks.
Yep.
You can plant apple trees and you get cedar apple rust.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's cedars everywhere.
Everywhere. Yes. Yep. Yes, yes.
So
anyhow.
They just take a lot of work.
A lot of work for a little return.
And it takes a long turn.
Oh yeah,
a long time to get that to get that return that does provide a big attraction.
Yep.
You know, if you plant an apple tree, of course you've got to plant multiples, you got to plant some cross pollinator trees, you got to do pruning, you got to do spraying, you got to fertilize, you got to keep the weeds at bay during the early years. You got to cage them to keep the deer off of them. And then when you do all that, it may be 8 years before you see enough produced to really be attracting the deer for a period of time.
A huntable period of time.
A huntable period. Like we're in.
And here's the other thing.
I don't like those odds.
Well, here's the other thing too. How many times do you see people, even at that, put a fruit tree on a property close to a cabin or something that really isn't a very huntable location? Anyhow, it's like, well, I want the attraction to the farm. Well, if you're going to go through all that, put it in a place where you can hunt them.
Yep.
Or at least shoot them during daylight. Like, they're going to come around the cabin at night, but that's it.
Yep.
Ugh.
And then, I mean, you look at, like, pears drop in the fall. Apples can, depending on the variety, drop in the fall. Cherries, like, the domesticated ones. No, that's late summer, I believe, most of them. And then peaches, late summer, not even during deer season.
Right.
And then the others are native ones. So it's like, you know, if you're going to plant an apple tree, I like Arkansas Black, but it does take time. It's one of those things where if it's something your family's into, do it. But if you're, like, trying to maximize your time and your return on your investment, it's
Move
not
on.
With planting fruit trees.
Pick up the chainsaw, go cut some trees.
Yeah, for sure. And then you got other types of trees that are pretty common. You've got maples, various types of maples. You've got a couple different types of elms. You've got, oh, you do have pine.
I
was going to say, shame on you.
No, I got
went all through that and you didn't even include pine. And then you got box elder. And about some of the, you know,
there's still so many other ones, but
it's just like, though, we talked, we're saying, oh, there's still so many trees, but you know, the amount of forbs, the amount of grasses, the amount of shrubs, like
the diversity. I would, you know, there's probably way more forbs and grasses on the landscape than there are varieties of trees. I feel pretty dang confident in saying that. So,
yes, there's
a lot of trees here, but there's so many grasses and forbs that we just had not covered. And that may be only grow in specific regions, but a lot of the trees, they just, you know, they have very big geographical regions. So mid-story, kind of wanted to get to mid-story.
Yep.
Because I think that people often will consider the mid-story as not impacting their... the light transmission into like the forest floor, like through the canopy. They think it doesn't really ever do much. I've been to so many places where it's like, you need to hammer the mid story, almost like wipe it out because you're not, it's completely shaded. You're not getting oak regen in here.
Well, how many times do you see a forest that is it's closed canopy or it's almost closed canopy and it's a mix of hardwoods, oak and hickory. And there's only, a low percentage, 15% that's marketable timber.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is low quality, unhealthy trees or species that we don't really aren't managing for. And then the mid story is a lot of these soft wooded trees. And then the very understory is nothing.
Yeah.
And it's like, you realize that if those crop trees die or are cut,
you have nothing
the
left.
Future of this is... the unhealthy trees that are already in the canopy and these mid-story trees that aren't what you want anyway.
That's
that's a responsibility
coming up
that falls
coming
on
up in the future.
You.
There's going to be, we haven't even talked to the guy yet, but we know it's an important story, and it's the future of the White Oak market, and how there's going to be, if we don't get on it now, there's going to be major problems down the road of lack of hardwoods like White Oak.
Yeah, I mean, and we see it because we're evaluating timber across the country all over the place, but whether it's lack of fire, lack of other disturbances, lack of follow-up from timber sales or invasive species, just shaded, you know, way too much shaded canopy. The fact is you're just not seeing oak regeneration like you ought to in a managed system. So anyhow, a lot of people either don't treat the or don't respect the mid-story and think that it's, you know, oh, I had a timber sale, they cut some saw logs, that was the light that I needed. No, you need to go back in there and hammer the midstory that was growing underneath the canopy and now is beginning to shade and fill in and rob your sunlight. But then the other thing is, on the flip side, I also see people trying to go in and manage timber and only cut the softwoods, only cut the midstory.
Yeah.
And not touch the canopy because maybe the tree's too big and they're not comfortable felling it. But you can't go in and
or
hammer
it's a
the
white
midstory.
Oak and all white oaks are good.
Right. And you can't, but you can't go in and just hammer the midstory and then look up and be like, I'll get enough light through there. No.
No.
Like you most likely will not. You need to either do that as a follow up practice after some sort of timber harvest. Hopefully there's marketable logs in there to be able to remove.
Yep.
Like you have to be able to do something.
Some of our mid-story, you got it. Sunlight, name of the game. Mid-story trees that we typically see, you know, we talked about flower and dogwood in the shrub podcast, but it's kind of a mid-story tree.
And it's got a soft mass,
too. Most importantly, so flowering dogwood, phenomenal. American black gum, sassafras, redbud, ironwood, musclewood, or the hornbeams are all pretty common.
See them all over the place.
And then, of course, your mid-story can be white oak, red oak.
Sure.
But so many times we see it more in these softwood type.
Because they handle shade pretty decently.
Yeah.
Or they grow and spread a canopy out wide like a flowering dogwood, have very broad leaves, capture what little sun they
can. Start their flowering process before the oaks put their leaves on in the spring.
And have the ability for them to grow and creep and find that shade. I mean, that sunlight.
Yeah.
They're not just, you know, perfectly
going straight
vertical.
Up.
Right.
Yeah. And then, of course, another category is native versus non-native. We mentioned a whole bunch of native species in the last 15 minutes. Non-native ones that we see a lot of, I mean, this list is long, but tree of heaven being a pretty common one.
Very prolific.
Empress tree or princess tree, people call it. Another mid-story tree I forgot is the American bladder pod.
Yeah.
That's where I've found it in the past. You saw a lot of it recently in North Carolina. So non-native, other trees, non-native. Oh, man. I'm drawing a blank.
Ginkgos.
There you go.
Some ginkgo trees.
Yep. Yep. Oh, you forgot.
Redbud?
Nope. I was thinking that tree tulip poplar. Did we mention tulip poplar or yellow poplar anywhere?
Have not yet.
Yeah.
There's a part.
That's
later
a native
on
one,
gonna,
but
yes. Yes.
Yeah, but it's not. I just thought of that. So, non-native trees
that we see a lot of. That doesn't do anything. It has it's seed, but sweet gum.
Oh,
gum tulip poplar to me, they're just cousins.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Cousin Eddie.
Man.
Can I get you anything? Drink? Maybe drive you out in the middle of the desert, leave you for dead? That's kind of how I feel with sweet gums and tulip poplars. Can I get you anything? Maybe you drink a herbicide, drive you out in the middle of the desert, leave you for dead?
Leave you to your thirst.
Yeah. Oh, man. So for each animal species, we're going to break down now kind of kind of turn the corner and take these trees into how they benefit wildlife. Ooh.
Start real quick with quail. Besides acorns on some of the like post oak, we didn't mention blackjacks.
Yeah, we didn't. Blackjack.
And some of the shrubs and everything like that. That's essentially going to be your only hard mass producers in the tree form that would benefit quail. Really, everything else is most likely a absolute negative.
Yeah, and whether it's removed. A raccoon escape from coyotes, so it gives raptor raccoons perch. Or a raptor perch.
At that point, there's other things that will provide the thermal cover.
I think if you were to ask a quail and say, would you rather have this tree so sometime in October you get some acorns, or would you rather not? They'd say, I'll find something else to eat.
I'll find some ragweed seed in October.
Get that raccoon or that raptor hawk perch out of here.
Yep, for sure. So very little benefit for quail. Turkeys, obviously, they need them to roost in, right?
Yep.
But really, almost any tree will do. They'll find those. Yep. And then we didn't mention cottonwood trees either.
No, we didn't.
But other big benefit is hard mast.
Yeah.
And some thermal regulation too in the summer.
Yep.
They will go into big river bottoms, creek bottoms, all across the country during those time frames, and honestly spend a bunch of time in the shade, in the cool, loafing, foraging. But mass production wise, that's a humongous food source for turkeys. But once again, they don't need a closed canopy environment to have mass production.
No.
That is such a, honestly, if you take one thing away from the podcast I hope that it is closed canopy forest doesn't mean good acorn production, and you don't need a ton of trees to have still ample acorn hard mass production on a property, on a landscape. So essentially, beyond that, beyond roosting and beyond a food supply from October through, February, March timeframe, that's really it. There's not a lot of other benefits that they have. Those are great. Those are super important. Those are necessary. But that's not all trees. That's hard mass producers. And they will eat soft mass too. They'll eat cherry. They'll eat hackberry. They'll eat dogwoods, the dogwood berries. They'll eat sassafras. Like, they'll eat a bunch of things. But a lot of other species too are foraging on those as well.
Yep.
So there's a huge mix there, but there's a lot of trees that don't justify being present on a property, even for a turkey.
Yeah. Yep.
Deer. Really?
Oh.
I mean, you take away the roost side of things for turkeys, you pretty much have a similar requirement, but it's less on the soft mass, more on the hard mass.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other aspect that we haven't talked about is necessarily the management of trees. The biggest benefit that I look at and see, if it doesn't produce, if it's not a healthy tree, probably needs to go. If it's not a mass-producing tree, how can I change its form to make it beneficial for nesting cover, to make it beneficial for bedding cover, or maybe I can turn and lower its form, recut it, and it'll resprout, and then it'll have tons of browse, woody browse. That's what I'm looking for from a deer standpoint. If it's not a good quality mass producer, that they're going to forage on,
and even if it's a mass producing tree species, if it doesn't produce it or it's unhealthy, we can change it up.
Or
and
if
make
I
it.
Have hundreds and hundreds of them, I'll cut some.
Mm-hmm.
I won't care. And honestly, a lot of the younger oak saplings will hold their leaves like a beech tree throughout the fall and winter, and that's great cover when it resprouts. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of value there for deer, but I think I go back to the definition there, and I see single stem trunk growing at considerable height.
bearing lateral branches.
Yeah.
I like the tree, but I want to use it in a different way in a lot of situations that will benefit. Because, like, again, you think about, let's just go with, I'm trying to think of a species. Let's just go with a box elder, right?
Yeah.
If it grows up and is 30 foot tall, is it doing anything for any of the species that we talk about? No.
Not much.
But if I cut it, the canopy will be on the ground. Maybe I'll have where it should be growing.
It'll stump sprout like crazy.
It'll stump sprout like crazy. I got food, and then I've got some vertical structure, but then I've also got some more light on the ground. Maybe I'll have...
great cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wild rye grow in there, and a turkey's going to lay its nest right there in the canopy.
Yeah.
And in the wild rye, boom, done.
Yeah. Box elders are made to be cut.
Soft wood.
Yeah.
They fell easy. I love cutting them.
Beautiful wood, too, sometimes.
Yeah. That red heart in there. It's
so beautiful. Here's one for you. If you could only pick one, let's just take trees in general and say, these trees are only going to produce hard mass, soft mass. And they have to grow in the form to do that. So
grow in the form of a tree to do
of
that.
The tree. So they're either going to produce hard mass, soft mass, or those trees are going to produce nothing but woody browse. Can't have it both ways. What would you rather your trees do? Provide woody browse and only woody browse? Or would you rather them produce hard or soft mass?
Well, that's easy. I'd rather have them woody browse.
Because I think you could produce way more forage.
I think of...
Consistently.
Consistently
as
forage.
As well as cover.
Absolutely. You kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
So I'm way more for managing as a shrub. And that is the value of taking a root system that has established and grown a single stem tree to the heights of maybe 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 foot tall. I'm not starting back over.
Yeah.
If I cut that, I have an existing root system that has, let's say, a lion's share of space, nutrients, energy there that will send out what I want in the form. So I know a lot of people are like, oh, I love planting trees. I love doing this and that. I love cutting them because it's almost like I'm also increasing the daylight, you know, back on the ground, but I'm also allowing that stump to re-sprout and provide the browse in a very, let's say, high energy packed manner. Like there's a lot that's going to be feeding those sprouts. If it grew that tree over time, what can it do for sprouts?
Yeah.
And it's going to keep, it's just a factor. It's like a diesel engine. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's just going to keep going and keep going and keep going. And that's what I love about the fact that you can utilize a tree if you identify its species, hard mass, soft mass producer, or it is just good when it's cut. I'm going to cut it, and I can change its form and shape and provide something else to the wildlife. And honestly, you know, shrubs and forbs, they don't really have that capability. You know what I mean? Like, it is what it is, and they're great at their role, but a tree does have a little bit of flexibility. And so you're either hard mass producer, or I'm going to give you a different job by cutting
it. I think that shrubs, so many of the shrubs are... It's like they have the density and the strength of a tree smashed down into the height of a shrub.
Yeah.
To where like an American plum is not necessarily browsed on great. Some of the shrubs are browsed a lot better, like American Beautyberry.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the dogwoods are grazed are browsed on
very heavily.
A decent amount.
I think red oaks.
But it's like when you get into trees. And you bring them down into woody browse structure or into the height where they can be browsed on. They're way more selective than shrubs.
I think that's, there's two things going on there. I think that a lot of times when you do cut them, you see that, you see the return and you see deer coming back to them, pounding them. Because if you have a forest and you don't have a lot of shrubs, then when you create a limited resource there. So it's like, there's not a lot of this. I need to pound it. I need to eat it.
Yeah.
And so it's like it's more concentrated forage.
Yeah.
But
without a doubt, it's going to send off more tender ends.
Yeah.
As if you're taking a big root system rather than that shrub's root system, and basically changing its form.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. If you were to have a preference for wildlife, would you rather favor white oaks or red oaks on a property when cutting, managing the timber?
Oh, man. Oh, well, it'd have to be depend on the site, I think. Like north slope, east slope, west slope.
Let's just say you had both. But just from the wildlife side of things.
From the wildlife side of things, I would probably say I'd favor more red oaks just because I have a better chance of every year producing acorns.
Absolutely. I think of the flowering production.
And I think of just overall, I think that they probably... Now, that's a little bit more difficult because they're not going to be as fire tolerant as my ground would be. Mm-hmm. So probably white oaks would fit in better.
Yep.
So I would I might have to retract and crawdad on you here and say, you know, if it's in an ideal world where I am doing prescribed fire and I am managing for woodland, then I'm going to go with the white oaks because I can go more savanna setting. They can handle fire while the red oaks don't tend to be a savanna type setting. So there you go.
You went a little more complicated. I was just thinking just from the mass producing side of things, not, let's say, whole land management.
Then I'm going red oaks.
Yes.
Yeah. If I'm just focused on mass producing, then I'm going red oaks.
Favoring, you want both. Again, this is a puzzle. Yeah. But again, we talked about the way they flower, the way that they produce in the two-year cycle. In addition to, they're going to lay on the ground, be viable for much longer into the winter.
Yep.
I think that their time span has way more prevalence and benefit to fat reserves, turkey populations, that amount of food that they're producing than white oaks do.
We forgot to mention sawtooth oaks.
There's a reason for that, people. Yeah. They're non-native. Yeah. Stop it.
So I think that probably made people think a little bit about the favoring the red versus the white.
Yeah.
White gets so much love, articles, blogs, blah, blah, blah. But truthfully, when you look at it, it's necessary to have a favoring of red oaks on the property.
Yeah, yeah.
If it fits, I'll say this too as a caveat: if it fits into your management regime and the property, the location, and the way it sets up, that might not be the case for a property in North Dakota.
Yeah,
it may not be the case for a property in Oklahoma, but if the shoe fits,
yeah,
I'm going to favor red oak.
Oh, not every tree is positive.
Well, I think we've kind of been covering that throughout the whole thing. Yeah,
we're skipping around here, and I'm trying to make sure we go through our notes. But
I added that in there to simply say, just because it's a tree
doesn't mean you can't cut it.
Yeah, I mean, again, we talked about the root sprouts, the stump sprouts, this and that. But think about the open space that you have now for other species like grasses that we covered, like forbs, like brambles, to come in and grow in the place of where that tree used to stand.
Yeah.
Again, we don't have to manage just a closed canopy forest or just a old field or just a grass pasture. Let's mix it all together so we have plant communities. But cut some trees.
Yeah, management of timber. That's the big thing that happens, or lack thereof, management of timber. So many times, timber is just like, always just like, even if your goal is just to grow trees to make an income, you should still manage it.
You still have to cut them.
It's not just like, let it cook, let it stew, just let it boil. We'll get to it one day. No, you got to cut out the junk. You got to cut the trees that are low value, that are competing. You got to thin the timber. And by doing that, you're going to improve the amount of habitat, food, and cover, and make your trees that you're trying to promote healthier and have more nutrients. So if you're not actively managing your timber areas, you're paying taxes and not getting the reward for it.
And you're slowing up your interval between cuts.
Yeah.
Your growth rates are decreased or stifled.
If your goal is to get two timber harvests in your lifetime
or three, you need to be actively managing in between those.
Totally.
So
totally do.
Yeah. So timber harvesting, that's one way. Felling, herbicide treatment, hack and squirt.
Stump treatments.
Cut stump, just thinning the timber. Prescribed fire.
Yep.
And then you got forest stand improvement, timber stand improvement, and then you're doing all this to hopefully not only put habitat on the ground for multiple species, but you're also putting money in your pocket eventually.
At the same time.
With the timber harvest. That's why
yep.
I don't like the when people tell me, well, I'm only managing for wildlife, so I don't really care about timber harvest. Well, I don't like so what, I don't so like what, money. What do you right. mean by that? Like, that just blows my mind. It's like, yeah. If you have the possibility to make money, why wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not like the feasible recommendation would be like, oh, okay, so tomorrow I'm going to recommend to you to go around and let's just cut every single tree and then treat the stump. We're not going to do that. Even with that statement, like that doesn't make sense.
I totally believe you can have your cake and eat too. Now, yeah, it won't be as thick if you're managing for timber, and by thick, I mean you won't have that thick, dense cover for wildlife.
Yep.
But you won't at have the same time.
The stocking rate will be different.
You'll still have good habitat as well as timber harvest. Like,
yep. Stand density will vary between the two to have your cake and eat too. But you can still make money on a rec property with managed timber and not decrease or not sacrifice quality habitat. You know, when you look at some of the recommendations that we'll commonly do, whether it's light, medium, heavy, super heavy TSI, but it's like there's a lot of times where it's just a medium TSI, and over time, guess what? Trees grow. So, like, you've created this by reducing the canopy, you've added light, you've got forbs and grasses and all the understory, whatever. But over time, those trees are going to continue to grow and yeah. fill that light situation back in. Go back in there and do it again.
Yeah.
Or maybe have a harvest, and then you follow up the harvest with more FSI or TSI, yeah. whatever. It's an ongoing process.
Let's talk about trees and their 12-month calendar benefit. So, like, how yep. are trees benefiting wildlife in January?
Red oaks. Hopefully there's some left over.
If there's still acorns on the ground.
Yep. Yep.
That's how they're doing.
And there are some trees, like, down south, swamp, stuff like that. They drop late.
Yeah.
I think of nuttalls, I think, drop super late in, like, December, January time frame.
So January, basically, the benefit they're providing could be nut producing, so yep. hard mass. Soft mass is pretty much over.
If they've been cut, then they have ample woody browse.
Yep.
But they have to be cut, though.
They have to be cut. If you have not cut your timber, you're sitting here hoping that in January
an ice storm comes and knocks the trees off.
Or a windstorm, or the fact that there's plenty of acorns still on the ground. February, same story as January. Unless you're cutting
yep.
the trees,
yep.
you're just hoping that there's acorns left over. March, same story. You're just hoping there's plenty of acorns left over, or you have trees that are on the ground providing woody browse. March, some of these trees start putting off leaves, but if you have closed canopy mature timber, it's out of reach. And by this time, the acorns are gone.
Gonzo.
So nothing.
Yeah.
Same story for April.
Yep.
Same story for May. Same story for June. Same story for July.
There's some shade component when we start getting into July
and
August. But yep. no food value.
No food value.
Unless it has been cut.
Unless it's within reach.
Yes. Yes.
Yep. And then same story for August.
Yep.
You know,
there's some
down
soft mass.
You're really trying to get. Yeah. Now we start getting, I guess I should go back to July and say there's some soft mass trees like peaches and, mm-hmm. and trying to think of some native ones that would be, we forgot another one too that's going to hit in late summer, early fall, pawpaws.
Yeah, pawpaws for sure.
But
yep. Yeah.
Who's managing for pawpaws for deer? Let's be honest.
There's a heck of a closed canopy system there. They're a great mid story. I said great necessarily, but they're mid-story soil.
Yep. Hope shaded. That the raccoons don't get to them first.
Yep.
So yeah, there's just not a lot of benefit. Now you go into August and we're looking at thermal regulation on east and north facing slopes for cover, but no food value unless you've done some cutting. September, into some hard mass producing, like chinkapins are dropping September, white oaks drop September. So you start getting into hard mass production.
I will say back to that thermal cover real quick. That they don't have to use that. Usually there's a lot of other sites too that have shade, but that is one benefit, a fractional benefit, let's say.
Yeah.
So then we're back into September, October.
Yeah. Hard mass producing. Yeah. Hard mass, soft mass, apple trees. Mm-hmm. So September, October, November, December.
Yep.
Basically, it's September, October, November. Those are your big months. And depending on the species, depending on location, depending on the mass, the crop. 3 months?
Out of the 12 months. And I'm going to say this, 95% of the people, that's all you're getting from your timber.
Yeah.
Because there's probably 5% of people who have adequate trees that have been cut and or have the woody browse component that we talked about.
And then even then, if they haven't cut it at all, they're not getting maximum production out of their mass anyway.
No. And so, comparatively speaking, let's just go through the months just real quick about if you have cut the timber, if you have a managed timber, the benefits lay. January.
Woody browse, cover, phenomenal.
February, same thing.
Same thing. March, same thing. April, same thing.
May, June,
phenomenal,
July,
phenomenal,
same thing.
Phenomenal.
Food, every time. And then that's why we have to have a balance, though, when we get
and
back into late summer.
And then you hit September, October, November, and they're producing more hard mass because they have more nutrients and they have more sunlight. So they're producing, those big trees that you've released are producing way more in amidst all those others that you cut down that have been providing woody browse.
Throughout the rest of the year.
And cover throughout
that's
the rest of the year.
That's why you have to have both.
Yeah.
At a right balance that makes sense for the property, that hunts the property well. And so cut the trees. Don't be scared. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the vegetation management series covering all things from top to bottom, grasses to trees. We'll do more series. And if you guys have ideas, reach out to us on social media about maybe something that you guys would like to series that you like to hear about. That was fun. I think it was good. I think we got a lot of feedback on it. Yeah.
Next week is we're stepping in the political series.
The heck with that. No way.
All right, guys. Appreciate you joining us, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.